This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Sales of existing homes just hit their lowest level in 15 years. And when homes aren't selling, Americans aren't moving. And that means the country that's famous for our mobility, folks, we're stuck. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, August 24th. Well, today's housing report was just plain lousy. Sales of existing homes down 27%. In July, it was the lowest level for single-family homes in 15 years. Now, in a moment, we're going to talk about where this economy might be going. But first, we'll stop and think about where we are not going. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
What does it mean when home sales slow so much, even with home prices way down and mortgage rates really cheap?
People are essentially being frozen in place by the recession.
Demographer Kenneth Johnson at the University of New Hampshire says one key group is really frozen in place, middle-class families. They often own homes already. Usually, they're moving around a lot, trading up into a bigger house or relocating.
They're saying, why should we risk moving? You know, even if I get a new job in a new place, we don't know whether the spouse is going to be able to get a new job. A lot of the larger companies, people are turning down transfers because they're hesitant about whether they can sell their houses.
Johnson says older people also aren't budging. Ordinarily, they'd be moving on, making room for the families with kids.
The retirees are saying, you know, we've got the money to move if we want to, but our 401s aren't as big as they used to be, and I don't know if we're going to be able to sell this house, so why don't we just stay put?
That decision to hunker down for potential buyers often comes down to price, says University of Wisconsin economist Tim Riddio.
If consumers start developing expectations that housing no longer generally goes up in value, that house prices are flat or even declining, that takes away an incentive to move now. You'll wait for a cheaper price in the future.
Portland realtor Jeff McBride is seeing buyers wait for ever better deals. People who own homes are refinancing with low mortgage rates, then remodeling.
They're just kind of sitting on the fence a little bit. You know, people are worried about their jobs, and they actually decide that, hey, I like my neighbors. The house I'm living in isn't so bad.
And they'll be gossiping over the backyard fence with those same neighbors for a while until the economy gets better and people start moving again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
So be nice to your neighbor. News of a stuck housing market has put new juice into the question we have been hearing all summer long. Are we headed for a double-dip recession? That's when the economy shrinks and then grows and then shrinks again. Well, most economists say that is still unlikely, but it's getting less unlikely. And it's worth asking, if we do shrink again, are we any better prepared for the second dip? Gus Fauché is director of macroeconomics at moodyseconomy.com. Gus, welcome to Marketplace.
Thanks, Bill.
It feels like we've been preparing for another recession. People who can have been paying down their debt, not spending. Of course, that's part of our problem. But would it make a second recession easier to bear?
I think so. I think households have cut back on their use of credit. They've raised their saving. So I think they're going to be in much better financial shape if we do experience a double-dip recession this time around than they were when the last recession started.
If you still got a job.
That's right. I think the key is that for people who are still working, that they've done a good job of paring back on their debts. They've done a good job of saving more, and so they're in better financial shape.
And what about our companies? They, in a way, they've been preparing too. They've been criticized for being so conservative, sitting on their money and not hiring. How positioned are companies to weather a double-dip recession?
They're fairly well positioned. Profits are up, in part because firms cut back so sharply on labor during the recession. They've refinanced their debt. They've paid down some of their debt. So if you look at interest payments as a share of revenues, that's way down. So firms are holding on to their cash. They're being very cautious, and that will serve them well if we do experience a double dip.
Well, would that mean that a double dip recession doesn't have to mean another jump in unemployment? Maybe companies don't have to keep cutting?
Well, I still think we'd see job losses, but certainly nothing on the same scale as what we saw earlier. One reason is that firms have less room to cut labor simply because they cut so sharply during the past recession. But also, you know, I think that they're still going to try to maintain their profitability, but they're in better shape going in. So I think the cutbacks would be less severe this time around.
We're all worried to some extent about government debt. How would another recession hit governments that are already underwater with voters who don't want to go into more debt?
Well, certainly we'd see the federal budget deficit widen. There'd be more spending on social programs as the unemployment rate moves higher. And then also we'd see revenues fall. People are going to be getting less income, so they're going to be paying less in income taxes and payroll taxes. And then states and localities would have a very severe problem. They're just right now starting to come out of the big hole that they've been in because of the recession. Unless they get more aid from the federal government, though, with a double dip, they would need to make even more budget cuts, so we'd see bigger layoffs at the state and local levels, and it would be a real problem.
What is the risk, Gus, that we're overprepared, that all our hunkering down might cause that double dip recession?
Well, certainly that's some of what we're seeing, and that's why people are so nervous. Businesses are reluctant to hire until they're sure that the increase in demand is real. Consumers are unwilling to increase spending until they're sure that the labor market is going to turn around. And that, in turn, is leading to some anxiety in the economy because we aren't seeing the job gains that were expected. So there certainly is a potential for this to become self-reinforcing and to actually cause a double dip recession.
What's your forecast, Gus? Are we recovering or are we slipping backward?
We're growing, but slowly. Certainly not enough to create enough jobs to bring down the unemployment rate. It's going to be another rough 6 to 9 months, and then we should see things pick up early 2011, start to see some stronger job growth. Consumers will feel better, and we'll see the unemployment rate come down. But it's going to be a pretty difficult process.
Okay, a big unpleasant-tasting single dip. We'll call it.
Yes.
Gus Fauché, Director of Macroeconomics at Moody'sEconomy.com. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
A difficult recession plus an upcoming election. Rub those two sticks together and you get heat. House Republican John Boehner turned up the rhetorical temperature today. The House Minority Leader called on President Obama to fire all of his economic advisors, including Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office also weighed in today. The CBO said the stimulus spending package that the president championed, it gave a 4.5% boost to the economy in the second quarter and saved more than 1 million jobs, which does leave the question, what happens when stimulus fades? Investors seem to be pondering that question today. Details when we do the numbers. Today, the Education Department announced the winners in the second round of its Race to the Top program. 9 states and the District of Columbia will split more than $3 billion. Race to the Top forced states to compete for a pot of money, and to win that prize, they had to promise to overhaul their schools. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports some states made drastic changes, and they still didn't win.
As in any race, there were more losers than winners. 46 states applied for the grants. Just 9 of them won today. 2 others won in the first round. To qualify for the competition, states had to agree to stringent reforms, like allowing more charter schools and tying teacher pay to test scores. Education Secretary Arne Duncan describes the lengths some states went to in the dash for cash.
Many of them have adopted new laws. All of them have adopted common, rigorous standards in reading and math.
Those standards were adopted by 35 of the competing states, but 2/3 of them won't get any money. So the Obama administration got what it wanted in the losing states without spending a dime. Jane Hannaway is an education policy analyst at the Urban Institute.
I think the administration was brilliant. I think it had a limited amount of money, and it got states thinking seriously about how to pursue those objectives.
But many of those objectives cost money. Jack Jennings heads the Center on Education Policy.
A number of the things that states said they would do if they got money, they're not going to be able to do because they won't have the money.
Education Secretary Duncan says there are other grants the losing states can apply for, but Jennings is dubious.
Well, the secretary is putting the best face on it, but nothing compares to the Race to the Top Fund. That is the major pot of money.
The Obama administration has budgeted for a 3rd Race to the Top competition next year, but Jennings says Congress will only authorize enough money for a handful of awards. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
And while the Education Department was handing out money, another part of the federal government was thinking of taking its money back. Yesterday, a federal judge issued a temporary injunction that blocks federal financing for embryonic stem cell research. The ruling could jeopardize more than $100 million in government funding, leaving researchers to rely on private money. And private money is where our next story comes in. There was news today that a virus similar to HIV might cause chronic fatigue syndrome. That finding could transform how the disease is treated and viewed, and it came courtesy of private individuals with deep pockets. From our Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Gregory Warner reports.
Wilhelmina Jenkins was on the verge of finishing her doctoral degree in physics when she came down with chronic fatigue syndrome, what the media was then calling yuppie flu.
I lost a lot of cognitive ability. I couldn't really understand my own research. So I would look at my own notes and not know what I had done before.
Doctors weren't much help, and neither were federal agencies that fund scientific research.
Science is hard. It takes time. We weren't expecting miracles, but we were expecting our government to take this seriously, and we did not get it.
In the end, the funds came from another source. Private grants kept researchers going. A foundation in Reno, Nevada, funded by the parents of a girl with the disease, was the first to trace a connection between chronic fatigue syndrome and a class of virus similar to HIV. That finding was reinforced by a study released this week by the National Academy of Sciences. It could lead to treatment with drugs used to treat HIV.
So you suddenly have a pathway and you have an audience.
Margaret Anderson runs Faster Cures. It helps family foundations take a more active role in medical research rather than just writing a check.
More often than not, people realize once they are diagnosed as a patient that there's no cures in the cupboard.
She says that private and foundation funds still make up only around 5% of total research dollars. But families can steer scientific collaboration, drive public attention, and keep studies going, at least until they're far enough along for a big drug company to pay attention. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Here's the latest on the summer of salmonella. The head of the Food and Drug Administration says it still looks like all the eggs are from a couple of farms in Iowa. The offending ova have sickened almost 2,000 people, and the recall just keeps expanding. 500 million eggs have now been plucked off the market, which got us wondering, how exactly do you recall 500 million eggs? Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains.
Let's put that 500 million in context. Bill hasn't done the stock market numbers yet, but here are the egg market numbers, courtesy of Krista Eberle at the Egg Safety Center.
There are about 280 million birds in the United States, chickens that produce eggs. And these chickens produce 300 eggs a year. So if you were to times 280 million by 300, you get around 80 billion eggs produced annually.
80 billion eggs produced annually. So that half a billion or so being recalled won't beat up the national egg supply too much. But when something like this happens, getting all those suspect eggs back is not really a possibility. Food and drug lawyer Justin Prochnow says the best producers can do in an egg recall is sound the alarms.
And it's really about trying to get the information out to the consumer so that they'll check on it themselves, but it's difficult.
So it's not really a recall, more of a call out. Prochnow says when it comes to supermarkets with tons of eggs to dispose of,
they'll hire a company like Waste Management or something to come out and destroy the food, and then they'll issue a certificate of destruction so that the FDA knows that they didn't resell the product, but they in fact destroyed it.
Though Prochnow says it's unlikely there will be a half billion certificates of destruction issued. Seems to me it would be a lot easier if these egg producers just used the Willy Wonka technique from the start. Remember the Eggdicator?
The Eggdicator can tell the difference between a good egg and a bad egg. If it's a good egg, it's shined up and shipped out all over the world. But if it's a bad egg...
Down the chute. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Well, I hope the Eggdicator works on meat, because today the big food producer, Tyson Foods, said it's recalling about 380,000 pounds of deli meat distributed to Walmart stores because it may be contaminated with potentially harmful bacteria, Listeria monocytogenes for you doctor types. Phew, vegan anyone? Coming up.
On one level, you can just say it's terrible and a national embarrassment. On the second level, you can say it's a perfect embodiment of where American public diplomacy is today.
We'll step inside the U.S. Pavilion at the World's Fair in Shanghai. But first, let's do the numbers. Investors fled stocks after that bad housing news I told you about. The Dow Industrials coughed up 133 points, about 1.3%, to end at 10,040. The Nasdaq said goodbye to 35 points, or 1.2%, to finish at 2123. And the S&P 500 lost 15 points, almost 1.5%, to settle at 1051. Probably no surprise, some home builders lost ground. Pulte Homes crumbled more than 1%. Toll Brothers dipped a fraction. A different story, though, over at KB Home. Shares pounded up nearly 2.5%, and Lennar nailed gains of 1.4%. Bonds rose as investors ran for cover. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.49%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By DeluxeCorp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking, Deluxe.com. And by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at MassMutual.com/mutuality. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for the month of July. The National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill and offshore drilling convenes its second public meeting. And love tomatoes? Don your goggles if you're in Buñol, Spain. The annual La Tomatina tomato fight is tomorrow. Gazpacho, anyone? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke, in for Kai Rizdahl, and you know who this is.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam.
Dylan. Love him or hate him, he is an American original, isn't he? Well, actually, Bob Dylan will be the first to tell you he's more of a borrower. He has always borrowed from the music around him. Old folk songs, blues, sea shanties, it all sort of mixed in his head. He would copy a lyric here, a chord change there, and then add a little something of his own. Well, that is not theft, says my next guest. That is the way the cultural commons is supposed to work. Lewis Hyde's book is called Common as Air, and he worries that we are privatizing our common heritage thanks to the rise of intellectual property rights.
It used to be the case that you had to register to get a copyright, but that's no longer the case. Everything that you create is automatically copyrighted. Your grocery list belongs to you. If I copied it without your permission, technically you could take me to court.
Well, should Bob Dylan and his record company not own his songs for a good long time?
I think that artists should own their work. The problem is how long the ownership should last. What's been happening in the last 50 years especially is an enclosure of the commons of the mind, as it were. When this country was founded, you got a 14-year property right in your writings. Now a corporation gets 95 years. I get, if I live long enough, over 100 years.
Well, the argument for intellectual property rights is that, first of all, innovators deserve to profit from their work, and also that that profit encourages more innovation. Is there an economic argument going the other direction in favor of holding more in common?
You know, often people think of common ownership and private ownership as at odds with one another. But in fact, they can work in tandem. Famous example in this country is that roads and waterways, navigable waterways, are held in common so that you can have commerce. A second example is the protocols that operate the internet. The great innovation in the 1990s was to throw them open to common ownership such that nobody had a stake in them and everybody can use them. And as a result, you got tremendous commerce on top of that. So one wants to think of the places where common ownership actually enables commerce and places where one or the other should better be the rule.
We're talking about the right number of years for a copyright or a patent, but it sounds like you're getting at something a little more philosophical about what it means to be people in community.
Part of the point of my book is to go back to the founding generation and to understand why they thought we might do this. And one of their great concerns was that we were trying to set up a democratically governed nation. And in such a nation, you want to be very wary of giving people power over expression. They wanted people to be able to act publicly in a scientific community, to act publicly politically. And they thought that the more private control you have over art and ideas, the less you were able to be a public person.
Yeah, Ben Franklin wasn't interested in holding his ideas privately, and he didn't think that's the way it ought to work.
Franklin got involved in trying to understand how electricity worked. It was always the case that you could not own a natural fact. So Franklin figures out, for example, that electricity has polarity. He's known as the discoverer of this, but he couldn't possibly own it. You can't own natural facts. One thing that's happened recently is that we have changed the rules such that biotech companies can own parts of the human genome. This is a great change. In Franklin's day, you couldn't do it, and rightly so. Franklin also was an inventor. He invented the lightning rod. He invented bifocals. And he could have, but never did, take a patent on these. This is an old ideal called civic republicanism. People often say, well, Benjamin Franklin had a lot of money by then, which is true. He was a very successful printer. But why do you have a lot of money? What is the end of becoming wealthy? In those days, the end was to turn yourself toward public service, and that was Franklin's ideal.
Lewis, do you mind if I copy your book and represent it as my own?
Well, there's two different pieces of that. One is attribution and one is ownership. I don't mind if you copy it, but you should attribute me correctly.
Fair enough. Lewis Hyde's book is called Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership. Lewis, thank you.
You're welcome.
The biggest World's Fair in history is underway right now in Shanghai. About 70 million people will visit the Shanghai Expo before it ends in October, and a bunch of them will stop by the United States Pavilion, which almost didn't get built. It seems American law prohibits the federal government from funding a pavilion for World's Fairs, so dozens of corporate sponsors stepped in. And the result? Well, we'll let our Shanghai Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz tell you about that.
After standing in line for 2 hours, the first thing Chinese visitors see inside the U.S. pavilion is a film of Americans butchering the Chinese language. The rest of the pavilion is much less straightforward. The next movie begins with a little girl's dream.
I made a car that runs by fruit juice.
It's sort of cute until her dream is interrupted by an adult. An adult representing the oil company Chevron. Its logo flashes on the screen.
The world needs energy to grow and prosper. Oil and natural gas, geothermal, solar.
That struck a very sour note for me.
Historian Jeff Wasserstrom is author of China in the 21st Century.
It seemed too much like an advertisement for products or for companies, for brands, stuck in there in a way that just didn't make much sense.
A far cry from, say, the French Pavilion. There you'll find masterpieces from the Musée d'Orsay and a typical French kitchen. The Spanish Pavilion has flamenco dancers. More than 50 American corporations donated $61 million to fund the U.S. Pavilion. A wall of their logos is the first thing you see when you enter, and a gallery of corporate exhibits guards the exit. Boeing, Dow Chemical, Walmart. The no smoking signs are sponsored by Pfizer. Adam Minter is author of the blog Shanghai Scrap.
On one level, you can just say it's terrible and a national embarrassment. On the second level, you can say it's a perfect embodiment of where American public diplomacy is today. It's largely been outsourced to people who have a financial interest in promoting their own agenda over the United States agenda.
Money talks even when it comes to a map of the United States. The map in the pavilion identifies only Texas, Tennessee, and Hawaii. Why? They're the only states that donated money. There's been no shortage of critics of the pavilion, even at the highest levels. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's two-word reaction after visiting the pavilion was, "It's fine."
I don't agree with the criticism that this is too corporate.
Martin Allentuck is CEO of the USA National Pavilion. He says the pavilion may not be perfect, but at least it was built. Public funding is impossible without a specific appropriation from Congress, which never happened. He says Americans should be thankful corporations ponied up. Plus,
it's very hard to say to a company, we want millions of your dollars, but, you know, you're not going to get to put your logo up, or you're not going to get to talk to the people who go through here.
It may be less than perfect to American eyes, but I talked to more than a dozen Chinese visitors. I asked them to resist their urge to be polite and give me a no-holds-barred review. No one had a bad word to say. This, after all, is a population that grew up surrounded by Communist Party propaganda. As consumers, they're bombarded with advertising from all sides. Here's visitor Zhu Shanbin exiting the pavilion.
It shows us the American spirit, which is multicultural and filled with imagination and creativity. From the movies here, I see Americans value children and good education.
Now that is some brilliant corporate messaging. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And I'll leave you with a pair of final notes today. Number one, Holiday Inn is offering to pay the checked bag fee that your airline charged you. You can see why a hotel is encouraging you to bring lots of luggage. More underwear equals longer stay. And I mentioned House Republican John Boehner calling on the president to fire his economic team. Well, the vice president, Joe Biden, is known for popping off with vulgarities. So when I saw he was going to respond to the minority leader, I sat up in my seat. Biden said, quote, "Very constructive advice, and we thank the leader for that." A little disappointing, but probably the right approach. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow plunged 133 points, about 1.3%. The NASDAQ lost 35 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 dipped 15 points, almost 1.5%. Thank you to Ethan Lindsay and Rod Abid on our Marketplace morning crew. You really should tune in tomorrow to the morning report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this show.
These days, a chicken leg is a rare dish.
Find out what that sentence has to do with the transformation of the wireless industry. I'm Bill Radke. I do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.